Welcome to Engaging with Psychoanalysis. I'm Tom Schumann. I'm a mental health counselor interested in better understanding the theory, history, and practice of psychoanalysis. I aim to do so through discussions with practitioners, thinkers, educators, and others involved in the psychoanalytic tradition. If you're interested in being a guest on Engaging with Psychoanalysis, please email me at engagingwithpsychoanalysis@gmail.com. Thanks, and enjoy the show. In this episode, I spoke with M. Carol Drago. Carol is a clinical social worker trained in psychoanalysis. She's practiced psychotherapy and psychoanalysis for 30 years. She's also a faculty member and supervisor at the Pine Psychoanalytic Center, as well as at the fellowship and advanced training programs at the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute. Additionally, she's a course director and adjunct faculty member at Harvard Medical School. In this discussion, we talk about the diagnostic use of countertransference.
I'm a mental health counselor, and in my training, countertransference was talked about frequently and vaguely. So I am very excited to talk to someone who has, it seems to have a real clear perspective on what the utility of, well, how countertransference, which I think we'll probably both agree is inevitable, to some degree, how it could be of use.
Sure. So I think countertransference is, in some sense, the therapist or the analyst's greatest ally. We really have no way of understanding our patient except ourselves. There is nothing else in the room that we rely on to understand what our patient is trying to tell us, except for our own instrument, if you will. And that instrument includes our feelings, thoughts, imaginings, body sensations. All of those are aspects of countertransference. And we, through some sort of combination of all of these sources of data, we arrive at ideas about what's happening with our patient, which we, of course, then present at times when the timing is right to our patients, who correct us or add to what we're saying, or we find sometimes we've hit the mark, and that can further, obviously, add to the therapeutic alliance, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how I think of countertransference, that it is sort of anything and everything that happens for the analyst or the therapist in the hour.
It's everything that the patient or client potentially evokes in us. And that is the most immediate and really the majority of the information we have about the client.
Well, it's really all that we have. I mean, if you think about it, you are sitting in a room with a patient. How in the world do you know this person except through your own self? There is no other way to know this person. There's no other way. I mean, if the patient was referred to you by an outside source, you may have gotten some paperwork, and it may give you some sort of demographic information, it may give you a diagnosis or some sort of a treatment history, or perhaps they're on medication and it may outline their medication regimen. But to really know the patient, to really have an understanding of who they are, the only way we can do that is through ourselves, right? There is no other way, is there?
Well, I always kind of, in my mind, countertransference refers mostly, and maybe I'm wrong here, to the, like, to the affective response we have to a client, and not as much to our intellectual response. I think part of that understanding of it is because in my training, you know, all of my professors, all of my supervisors were of different theoretical orientations from one another. So sometimes countertransference was almost strictly framed as something to be watched and avoided, and you know, it gets in the way of the more objective conceptualization of the client. But I feel in your description, both the affective and the intellectual aspects of our response to the client are encapsulated in the term countertransference. So I guess that distinction is important, but it's also, I would tend to agree with you that as much, you know, whether or not what we feel is being considered consciously, it is influencing our perception of the client.
Right. And I would say to you that there is no objectivity really in the clinical hour. There are two subjectivities, and there is no real objectivity. It doesn't actually exist, that there just exists a subjective understanding of another person's subjective experience. But the analyst is not objective, and I don't think can be. I don't think it's within the realm of possibilities, right? You're just a human like they are, and so you have these two subjectivities, right?
And I mean, even if it was possible, you know, would it
preferable?
Be desired?
Do we want it? Right, right. That's a very good point. Right. And something else you said about a couple of things, that your understanding about countertransference was that they were feelings or thoughts or from the analyst point of view that are problematic and then get in the way of understanding the patient's experience. And that was Freud's original idea about countertransference. You know, Freud came from a medical model. He was a neurologist, and he was trying to develop his theory base of psychoanalysis, and he was trying to fit his theory base into the model he knew, which was a medical model, which has objective facts, right? I mean, one can look under a microscope and see what is the bacteria. It's either this or that. It's very clear. And in our work, of course, it's a much, things are not as clear. There's always possibilities, and we work in the world of primary process in the unconscious, which is not in the world of undisputable or incontestable facts, right? Like, we don't operate in that world. When we're trying to understand what the interior of a person. Yes, someone, we know their age, we know their how they are appearing to us, but there's a lot of stuff that is that comes through an understanding, through our own subjectivity. So, but the concept of countertransference has really developed and changed throughout a psychoanalytic theory. And the contemporary understanding of countertransference is that it is the analyst's greatest, it's our bread and butter. It's how we come to know someone, right? So it's not so that what we think and what we feel, as you said earlier, is evoked by the patient, right? And now we do have to sort through what is evoked. So if a patient is talking about a difficulty with their partner, we may associate to a difficulty with our own partner. Now, what do we do with that association? Do we Do we try to pull what's the similarity and can we use it? Or is it a distraction? It is true. We have to sift through, is this useful to this patient or is it not? And we do it like within seconds usually. You know, our mind is busy imagining and thinking and formulating and doing all kinds of things while we're listening. And we just have to decide in those split moments what we are going to do with the contents of our mind as we are listening. And sometimes we recognize that what we're associating to is not useful to the patient. It really is related to our own history, and although it's being evoked by the patient, it may not be useful for us to, there may not be anything useful in there that we can share with the patient or use to understand the patient in that moment. Sometimes we find, though, later on, like when you're driving home from work, you go, oh, now I understand why that memory came to me. And I could have used it in this way, but we can't always know that in the moment. But we do have to sift through and see what we can use and what we need to leave sort of in parentheses and unarticulated to the patient, if I'm being clear.
Oh, yeah. And that would emphasize the need for analysts to have their own analysis, to kind of have that insight. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think for analysts to become aware of whatever the contents of their mind and what they're feeling, very specifically, for them just to have that awareness, to be open to whatever rises, because it rises from the unconscious and it comes up in us, and we have to allow for that and not be frightened by that or not try to suppress that. We need to allow for it, which implies the analyst having gone through an analytic process. And we also have to be able to contain whatever that is, which also implies an analytic, the analyst's own successful analysis. And we have to have worked through our own history of conflict, whatever that history was, so that if those areas become stimulated, that we don't become overwhelmed by them and or resist allowing that to rise in the mind because it's too frightening or it feels forbidden in some way. So yes, to become aware of and use countertransference therapeutically for the patient, the analyst has to have gone through a rigorous analysis. I think that's absolutely true.
I would imagine that one potential problem, if an analyst hadn't kind of gained sufficient insight into their own workings, if they were to see a patient who was too similar in certain ways to them, that they would be equally motivated to not see certain things, to not be able to pick up on certain things. Certain things would stay repressed because the motivation to do so would be equally shared.
It's possible, you know, it's very, or the analyst could become completely flooded and overwhelmed by whatever it is. And it's interesting, the thought of too similar, right? Because I think about this pandemic, and never has there been, I can only speak from my own practice, although I imagine this is shared by many therapists, analysts, never has there been a time where every single patient in my practice is struggling with the same anxieties and stress that I am, right? Mm-hmm. We're all dealing with intense isolation. We're all dealing with incredible anxiety about this virus and, you know, concern for relatives, concern for oneself, you know, getting sick, you know, all of this. And it has been quite challenging to allow the space for people to talk about their own worries and anxieties when I share so many of those myself. Now, people have very nuanced, you know, once you get past just the initial anxiety, there are very nuanced concerns that people have that I don't share. But the general tone, it's been quite challenging to try to remain open. It's been challenging for me to attempt to remain open 7 and 8 hours a day to people's worries and concerns about the pandemic, because I want to seal off my own worries so that I don't feel so stressed out. So it's really been a very challenging time. But I do think this is a highly unusual situation, right? This is just unusual. I mean, in general, I think if you've had a similar experience to a patient, and something in you gets really stimulated and your feelings become very strong in whatever way, whether it be a somatic feeling, or you just feel the affect itself directly and you can name it, or whether you start going into your mind and remembering how it was for you whenever it was that happened, it's really important to notice, like, what is the leading edge of the countertransference? Is it the feeling? And if you can use the feeling, let's just say sadness, if you can use the sadness to understand the patient, you can say, it sounds so sad, or I imagine there was a lot of sadness there for you. You can use your feeling. If you feel you can't, if you feel you're just going to cry, frankly, which happens sometimes, it's best, I think, to really just contain that affect and not refer to it and not articulate it and attempt to just move it to the side, and you can go back and look at that later. So I don't know if that was a digression from what you asked me or not.
to me, it sounds like a particular form of countertransference, one that is, you know, very one-to-one, very, you know, empathy-based, identification-based.
Yes.
My understanding is countertransference, it's not just what you might be so directly picking up from the patient, but also the role you kind of find yourself in with the patient. What they might be drawing from you in a similar way that they're drawing from other people in their lives.
Yes. So you're looking at, I mean, I think what you're talking about is how should we say? I mean, the old language is projection and projective identification, right? That's the Melanie Klein language, that the patient is projecting something into you and you receive it and identify with it. And so you become that person, or you feel those feelings that are being projected by the patient, right? Mm-hmm. So there's that thought. I mean, I do think that patients via the right? So you're also talking about transference, right? So, mm-hmm. Let's say someone had an abusive parent, a parent that was very angry and hostile towards them, and somehow you notice yourself feeling increasingly irritated with this patient. You know, maybe they show up late. You've tried to process that with them several times, or maybe they are also sort of aggressive towards you in a really subtle way, or they don't pay their bill, or any number of things that people can do relationally that you find yourself like not really liking this person and getting kind of angry with them. And then you have to wonder, okay, what is going on here? Like, why am I feeling this way towards this person? Yes, I can point to these actions, but why is it they are doing this? And so you can use your, let's say it's anger, you can use your anger with the patient to reflect back to them something like, you know, I noticed there is a feeling of hostility in the room. How can we understand this together? So you don't come out and say, I'm really angry with you, although there may be a place for that too at times, right? Maybe with particularly, you know, people, there might be a place for that. But you might just sort of generalize and say, I notice there's a lot of hostility, or this feels to be a lot of frustration between us. I wonder what's happening. Or you could say, I notice there's a lot of hostility, and it reminds me of what you've told me, you know, about your father, or something like that. So you can make the link if you think it is related to that early object relationship of the father, the angry father. You can make the interpretation or the link if you feel it's appropriate. Or you might want to leave it open-ended and have the patient make the link. There is some sort of hostility here. I'm wondering, are you feeling it too? What are your thoughts about it? And see where it goes. Mm. Does that kind of...
Yeah. I feel like... And I've enjoyed it, but I feel like we've ended up talking a lot about the, almost the restorative use of countertransfer. It's almost how it's utilized in helping the client gain insight or, you know, experience, some kind of reparative interaction. With regard to the diagnostic use of it, you know, when I was in my graduate internship, there was a senior counselor at the counseling center I worked at, and they were psychodynamically oriented, and they said about a client who had a borderline diagnosis. They said, you know, I went to picked up on that. I usually find myself really liking talking to people. Like, he was talking about knowing how much I enjoy this initial conversation, that's usually a good indicator that they have this type of personality organization. So that's really the extent to my exposure to someone really talking about countertransference in a diagnostic manner.
Well, sure. I understand what you're saying. I mean, if you're talking to a person and you find yourself, you know, your mind is wandering, you can't, and this is atypical for you. Let's say you're very focused, very, you know, you really zero in, and you find yourself all over the map, and you can't really focus, and you can't quite get a handle, and you can't quite, I mean, that tells you something about this patient, right? And if you trace the dialogue, if you process recorded the hour, let's say, you'd probably, I mean, I'm making this up, but you'd probably find a lot of content shifts, maybe the patient's eye contact isn't terrific. Maybe they are, every time you get close to some affect, they move away. In other words, it's a very jumpy hour. And you respond to that jumpiness by feeling anxious yourself. And so it tells you something about the patient. This person is really anxious. I'm feeling jumpy. I'm feeling unfocused. I imagine that's what's happening for this person, right? So you can gauge your own. I mean, I have been with people and just felt they're talking about something else completely, and I have a very strong feeling. And so I know that they are unconsciously communicating an affect to me that is not present in the content. So diagnostically, you say this person's feeling something. It may not be diagnosis in terms of an axis one or an axis two, but it is diagnostic in terms of the affect that's present in the room, even though it is not being directly stated in the content at all. You know, and borderline people, you know, it's such a difficult group of patients to work with. you can feel, you definitely feel that they're really difficult. And you, I'm trying to think about countertransference wise, they're usually quite demanding for one thing. They ask you to, they want a lot from you right up front. And you, most patients don't ask for a lot, but they ask a lot from you. You find yourself wanting to set limits with them. You find you want to hold back from them sometimes. So you can tell by how you're using yourself that this person is, there's something about that they need a lot more, that their ego is not well developed, and that all that they didn't receive a lot of what they needed when they were, you know, in those very early attachment years, and they are now coming to you with this kind of big empty space that they're looking for you to fill, and you can feel that.
And, you know,
I don't know whether that clarifies what you're asking.
It does. Yeah. There's a certain way. I mean, as I'm hearing it, there's a certain way that people presenting with certain difficulties tend to make clinicians feel. That makes complete sense.
And people who have strengths. I was just reading. I was going through my my Word documents, and I came across a letter of recommendation that I wrote for someone, and I started off this letter of recommendation talking about how it was the end of the week and I was very depleted, I felt very despondent. This was at the very beginning of the pandemic, but here was the scheduled hour to do this interview so I could write this letter of recommendation. And within minutes of talking to this person, I felt very energetic. I felt much lighter. I felt much happier. And it was because this person was incredibly warm. She had a lot of goodwill. She was very optimistic and enthusiastic. And that came across to me. And I felt really, it was like, I felt great. And so that's diagnostic of her. Like something came across. She gave me something just in her talking about her life and why she wanted to do this particular program, et cetera, et cetera. So it was really interesting. So there's another example of countertransference where it tells you something very positive about the person you're talking to, about their ego structure, about their the attitude of that they have about their life, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So to me, that signals the utility of, I'm trying to think how I mean to say this, but almost the utility of, not the utility, but the importance of, you know, because countertransference occurs not just in clinical settings, as you just laid out. We have countertransference with everyone we meet. We don't ever just come across somebody as they are. We're also dealing with everything that they evoke.
That we are.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So to me, it almost signals the social importance of helping people get to a place where they're internally organized and kind of, I don't know if I want to say healthy ways, but that because it affects other people, you know? Does that make sense?
Sure. Oh, absolutely makes sense. So people that have problems with their ego structure are people more than likely, they more than likely have trouble in relationships with other people, right? Because there's gaps and there's holes there that have been filled through various defensive maneuvers, and so they're going to struggle with other people. So we want to part of the way we discover these relational these gaps and how they show up in relationships is what shows up with us. And when that happens with us, we can then refer to, I guess we can make a guess and say, you know, gee, I wonder if what just happened between us is what happens between you and, oh, I don't know, the people in your family. You know, so, you know, if they've told us they have problematic relationships with their family members, you can try to help them make the link. And what we're doing is really looking at, we are getting close to whatever those defenses are. And once we can work through the defenses, we can work on building that ego structure. It shifts on its own. We really don't have to do a whole lot. It does it on its own through the process of internalization. So it isn't like we have to go mucking around. It happens on its own. It may have to be repeated numerous times, but it does happen on its own. So you're right. Part of our job is to help build, sort of undo and then rebuild faulty ego structures, right?
And the idea that it happens on its own, the vehicle through that, I'm thinking, is the relationship, is the therapy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's why the character of the analyst is so important. It's so important. Another reason why the analyst, you know, has to have gone through a rigorous analysis, because not that any analyst is perfect and every analyst has stuff that, you know, they haven't worked through and ways that they are don't see things clearly and ways they are defended, and of course, because they're just people. But if you've done your due diligence, you know, 10 years on the couch 4 days a week, more than likely, I mean, I'm just using that for example, it could be any length of time, right? We don't really know how long somebody's analysis needs to be, but it needs to be long enough that their kind of central conflicts, if you will, have been resolved. I mean, if anything can be truly resolved, but resolved so that they don't get in the way and you can use them to help you in your work, that they're not going to interfere.
And, you know, as far as I know, no other psychotherapeutic profession or trade actually requires clinicians to go to undergo treatment of their own.
You're right.
Yeah.
As far to my knowledge, psychoanalysis is the only training that requires that from the practitioners. And I think part of the reason why psychoanalytic training is so effective is that it has kind of three parts to it. There's the didactic, right, where you just do a whole ton of reading. There's the, and that reading takes place usually in a cohort. So you go through your training with the, and people do drop out occasionally, but you go through that didactic training with the same group of people. And it can be quite intimate. You really talk about the literature in very deep ways with the same group of people year in and year out. And it builds such an incredible bond, which is part of the training too. I think the cohort is part of the training. But it's didactic, and the second sort of another piece to the training is the supervision, so that analytic institutes that are affiliated with the American Psychoanalytic Association, those candidates are required to have 3 training cases, and each case requires a different supervisor. So you have 3 different supervisors that you meet with weekly. So you get this basically one-on-one training on from a supervisor on how to listen and what to do with the material that's coming up in the hour. And then the third piece of it is your own, one's own analysis, which is really important. So I think it approaches it from these 3 different ways, and it's very effective and really intense, but very effective training.
And, you know, so much of to bring it back to the diagnostic use of countertransference, so much of it, as you said, is subjective.
Yes.
However, we operate in a clinical context that that in many ways increasingly eschews the subjective, and the DSM is kind of what is outside of psychoanalysis, and the rest of the psychotherapeutic professions is kind of what you're one way or the other forced to reckon with, which is mm-hmm. anything but subjective. It's checklists.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I'm interrupting. Please continue.
No,
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that has to create some amount of tension.
Well, it's really interesting because I actually find the DSM helpful. I use it. Well, first let me say, for people that do not take insurance, and a lot of psychoanalysts do not take insurance, so if you have a private practice and you don't take insurance, essentially you don't have to deal with the DSM ever. I do take one insurance, so I do have to deal with the DSM because to get reimbursed, of course, you have to diagnose. So I do work with the DSM, and even for patients that that pay out of pocket, that I don't need to formally diagnose, I'm not required to, I find the DSM kind of helpful in terms of broad categories. So it helps me think, is this an affective disorder? Is this an axis 2 disorder? Like what exactly are there developmental issues I need to be thinking about? Do we have a medical problem here that's influencing either their cognition or just how they're feeling about themselves? So I actually find thinking about these broad categories is helpful to me. I don't think I get too hung up on does it meet 5 criteria or 2 criteria, although that can be helpful too, because it may, like sometimes reading the criteria can help the clinician think about, is this a manic episode, or are we looking at like a schizoaffective disorder? Like what exactly is going on here? So it can be really helpful for me to just in terms of how to think and conceptualize things. I know not everyone feels that way, or thinks about it in that way, but I actually find it helpful. And I don't feel like it categorizes people, like sticks them in a box, because it's just one broad brush of many things that I use, and I think many people use, to help them understand what's going on with somebody. If you have a patient who's very rigid, let's say they present as super rigid and they can't free associate and you can't seem to gain any ground and there's not a lot of affective presentation. So you have to think to yourself, okay, what are we dealing with here? Is this person like on the spectrum? Is it like Asperger-y? Are we dealing with it's just a super rigid psychic defense? So it can help you figure out what exactly who is this person, so you can figure out how to work with them and how to be helpful to them, and also prognostically what is possible, right? If it seems like, yeah, no, this person really is on the spectrum, then that relationally and affect wise you're probably not going to get too deep. Probably not. Maybe, but it's unlikely. Whereas if it's defensive, okay, like maybe there's possible shifts here. Like at least the psyche can possibly, there's some malleability there. So I find it helpful.
It sounds like you see it as having use as almost like an external reference. It's like,
yeah,
okay,
that's a nice way to think about it. Yeah. It just provides further information, for me. Yeah, that's a nice way to think about it, an external reference. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you have a very balanced attitude towards it. I feel like a lot of clinicians find it very stifling.
Yeah, sure.
Or, on the other hand, a lot of clinicians, you know, really treat it like a Bible.
Yeah, no, I don't do that. Yeah, no. I think if people find it stifling, it could be, it also could be, I have the luxury of being in private practice, right? So I don't have to write a diagnosis that has those five whatevers, you know, with every patient, and that has to be reviewed every 6 months, and I have to document, you know, observable change in each sphere. And I mean, if I had to do that, I might feel very differently. I mean, there have been times in my career, of course, I've worked at clinics and hospitals and did other things where the institution where I worked had really very rigid sort of paperwork requirements. Mm-hmm. And I found it really a pain in the neck. But I found that I just sort of did it. I thought, okay, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to meet these requirements. It may not be what it can't contain all the nuance I know about this patient. So I will just do this. And it almost felt like two separate processes for me. I have my own thoughts about the patient, and I had to fulfill this requirement of the agency or the hospital. So I just did it. You know, that's how I reconciled that tension that you're referring to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it sounds like a reasonable solution to do it, but also probably one that takes up a lot of energy.
It does. And I did find it really irritating at times. I found it really irritating. So I can understand for people who are, you know, working in those settings, and tons of people do, it can be really problematic, you know. They're trying to get their patient to fit into something, and that's not what it's about. We don't want to smush our patients into any sort of category. We just want that the DSM to help guide our thinking about what may be happening for somebody.
Yeah. I'm keeping an eye on the time.
Oh, yes, please.
I think we only have about 10 minutes left. And one thing, you had mentioned that some of the language you used early in the conversation around there being two subjectivities in the room. And, you know, a term that in exploring psychoanalysis, I've heard come up, but I haven't really, you know, dug in or reckoned with, is the idea of intersubjectivity.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could kind of elaborate. Not that you said it, but
sure. Yeah. You're right. So I am not. Let me say there is a whole literature on intersubjectivity, and I sort of just need to throw a caveat out there that I have read some of it, but I am not an expert on the literature on intersubjectivity. So I just need to throw that caveat out there. However, I will give you my understanding, and if other people listening to this have other thoughts, I'm really open to hearing them. But, you know, intersubjectivity refers to, as I understand it, the space between the practitioner and the patient. So it's the, Thomas Ogden wrote about the third, right, the subjective third. He's talking about the space between the analyst and the patient, that something exists between them. And the intersubjectivity people, that's their starting point. Their starting point is the space between. Mm-hmm. What is it that two people are creating together? And the idea is that both people are contributing to this space between, that it is not the objective analyst who has no contribution and is just, I don't know, somehow devoid from putting out anything into that space. I mean, it's impossible, right? So it very much recognizes that there are two full subjectivities in the room, and that each of them are contributing to whatever it is that is going on between them, right? Like that patient in your room different things will come up for that patient with a different therapist because it's a different therapist. that different things will be created. So each analytic pair or each therapeutic pair is unique.
Yeah.
Right? Certainly every therapist, every analyst has their own personality, their own way they like to work, they have a certain style. Every patient has a certain ego structure, certain defenses, certain thises and thats. All of that is true. But when they come together, they create a unique third, a unique something. And that's the intersubjective space, the space between.
I would think that might lend something to, you know, the phenomenon of patients going to see several different clinicians, and every clinician kind of has a different conceptualization of them. Yeah.
Right. Even though they may agree about certain things, like, you know, oh yes, clearly this person has a major depression, or, you know, this person has a terrible trauma history. Like, they might agree on certain things, but relationally things might be really different. Or they might agree, like, one therapist may be more comfortable working with a particular, the way a person presents themselves, certain, I hate to always talk about people with BD because it feels with borderline because it feels so isolating to them. But for people with certain personality configurations, right? Some analysts or therapists just are not comfortable working with that particular configuration, and that's fine. Whereas another analyst or therapist may find that for whatever the reason, they're completely comfortable working with that. So that's the same patient, different analysts, they just respond differently, right?
Yeah.
Right.
I wonder, you know, it feels like in discussions about psychoanalysis and in, like, relatively contemporary psychoanalytic literature, borderline personality does come up a lot. And I wonder if that's because psychoanalysis or psychodynamic treatments have kind of a special tool set for. You know,
that's such an interesting thing to say. I actually think that people with borderline personality disorder are absolutely treatable. And I hate that language, as I heard myself say, that sounds horrible. Let me start over. I think that people that have that personality configuration are able to get better. I do think they can get better. And I think perhaps the tool set you're referring to is that people with analytic training can, how shall we say this? I think have become so familiar with their own sort of unconscious material, their own primary process, affect and stuff, that when it shows up in the hour with a person with that personality configuration, we're not necessarily so put off by it. It can be difficult. It can be unpleasant. It can be completely maddening. It can cause the analyst to feel enraged. I mean, it isn't easy, but it's understandable. And because analysts work so closely in the transference, that's part of the tool set too, right? It's both, we're not put off by the affect, and we can also really interpret the transference. So this person's rage directed towards me, I will perhaps be able to interpret that it's really that somehow I am reminding this person of their mother or their whoever it was. And can we talk about how that is for them? So you move back and forth between the present and the past, the transference. You have to do a lot of work linking the present to the past, which is working in the transference.
It sounds almost as though when you're working in the transference, you're reflecting on your own counter transference. That while in many ways you're getting closer to the processes that that are occurring. In a certain way, it kind of gives you a distance because you're not taking everything so personally necessarily. You're not really, you're enmeshed in what's going on, but in a different way, in a way that perhaps slows it down a bit and mm-hmm. makes it a little bit more bearable.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, yes. It's interesting you use the word enmeshed, because I would say if the analyst or the therapist is enmeshed with the patient, then they have lost their ability to think. Mm-hmm. And that is classic with people who have that personality configuration. It's like they get into your head and you can't think, and you become enmeshed in this whatever it is that's in that intersubjective space. And it's very important to pull out of it so that you have the ability to think. So you can say, something happened between us just now that was very difficult. It would be really helpful to talk about it together. So that you're right, you can pull out of it to help you both think about what happened, which both contains the affect and also brings the possibility for understanding / change, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we should probably wrap up here, but I this has been a great conversation. I feel like I'm leaving it with a better understanding of the at least one psychoanalytic attitude and conceptualization of countertransference.
Great.